Hi, it's April 16th. This is Joe Hall speaking to you from Ithaca, New York. And these are my reading notes. This is the first one of these I've done, and I just want to give you a sense of what these are. It's not anything I've written with a script. These aren't book reviews. Evaluations of these texts in a considered way. I wanted to do these book notes as a way of just communicating what I'm reading and a little bit of what I'm thinking about. But in reality, I think these book notes are a way to get those thought processes started and to work them out through speaking about them. I just finished a PhD program and I'm kind of back out in the wilderness. And a big part of me is pretty sure that I'm not going to go into academia. I'm not going to continue to teach classes, even though I've had the opportunity to do that. And so one thing I'm really interested in is just leading an intellectual life outside of academia. A book that I just keep coming back to recently is been a guy at Thalmad Dunes, Adrenaline. It's Action Books. I think it was published this year. It says 2017. Translated by Catherine Cobham. Guy at Thalmad Dunes is Palestinian poet born in Syria, I think Damascus, and is now in Amsterdam. So he's kind of twice dislocated from Palestine and then, you know, in regard to the war in Syria. It's a powerful collection. It's politically pungent and engaged, but with the sense of humor, a grim humor, a gallows humor, an absurdity or surreality sometimes. In particular, the poem We is one I really can't stop thinking about. In it, Thalmad Dunes apologizes to Israeli soldiers. He apologizes over and over for making them blow him up. You know, the voice is kind of this, you know, voice of the collective massacred civilian. And it just sort of makes us think about the inverted logic that is applied to war, particularly to the war on terror, particularly to the occupation of the West Bank and the total like securitization of Gaza. It's an upside down world, and we're constantly, particularly, you know, in the United States, you know, are confronted with upside down logic, and that leads us, the United States government, to perpetuate and carry forward its violent imperial projects in the Middle East, and so, like, Thalmad Dunes in a poem like this where he's apologizing and taking blame for being an innocent, blown up person and saying, I'm so sorry you had to almost look at the fragments of my body. I'm sorry you had to push these buttons. We also apologize to the Israeli soldiers who took the trouble to press the buttons in their aircraft and tanks to blow us to pieces. And we are so sorry for how hideous we looked after they aimed their shells and bombs. So it participates in this inverted logic, but in a winking way. I think it asks us to see what happens if we take that crazed logic to its full extent. This logic of mislaid blame for the situation, you know, the various situations and crises in the Middle East, which make U.S. imperialists believe that they can identify the right actors to punish. There is another line in a section of a poem. The section is called Damascus, and then in Thalmad Dunes, recalls the sarin gas attacks in Damascus, and he writes, "This is an earthquake of a different kind, where houses remain stable and bodies do the trembling. This is a moral earthquake striking the world. This is a moral earthquake striking the world." Yeah, so the next thing, the next book, that's kind of put its hooks in me has been Tim Liu's Luminous Debris, New and Selected Ledger Man, 1992 to 2017. And, you know, some people have said this to me recently that, like, you know, so-and-so had saved my life, you know, through something they said or something they did. And, you know, I was like, that's a really dramatic phrase, but it's also kind of like a gift, you know. It's like this person did something they didn't need to do, that helped me so much. And I have to remark on that. And in a certain way, I just want to thank Tim, for that too. For his correspondence in the last couple of years and just hanging out and being a human and taking, me and my own work seriously at times where I don't know, I feel like I had lost a little faith and a lot of confidence, and just wasn't doing anything. So this is the poem. Oh shit, I got the wrong poem. I'm looking at the wrong poem. Oh no, okay, here it is. I mean, this is kind of an exceptional poem in the book. It's not like a lot of the other ones. It's called The Tree That Knowledge Is. I just wanted to read this, particularly for the first line, which I love. "I do not want to die, not for love, nor vision of that tree I cannot recollect, shining in the darkness with cherubim and a flaming sword. On my life, that still small voice of God coiled up inside my body. The lopped off branch that guilt is, it's not death, no life, but the lust that flowers at the end of it." So that's Tim Liu. The other thing I've been reading for, and it's kind of like a long-term project, but I do scholarship on the 17th and 18th century, and these things called fen riots, or, you know, we should just call them protests against the draining of swamps, were a big thing around the time of the English Civil War in the 17th century. And I'm interested in them because there are these mass sort of civil actions where people are collectively protesting outside forces coming into their community and appropriating what they need to live. So in this case, a lot of these folks rely on swamps for their livelihood, for fishing, and they rely on seasonally flooded meadows as well. And during, you know, the drainage movement outside, you know, we, you know, might want to call them developers, would come in, drain those lands, make a claim to them by saying, "Hey, you know, we did this work to drain them and improve them. Therefore, you know, by the power that's been, you know, vested in us, like, it's our land." And so a lot of people lose what's called their common rights, their rights to use these lands communally, to use them as a group. And so they use their use rights to them in favor of outside forces having absolute right to them as property. So, you know, it's part of the history of the theft of the commons, the enclosure of the commons. And surrounding all this is the shift into market-based capitalism, market-based agriculture in England. But anyway, I mean, that's a long way of saying, you know, I was reading a chapter called Drainers and Fen Men in a book called Order and Disorder in Early Modern England. And this guy, C. Holmes, is writing about the riots in a place called Axholme. And one of the strategies of those who are trying to discredit these protesters is to split them up and to say, you know, oh, these riots are, they're just led by the rabble, or these riots are just led by a few, you know, bad actors, which, you know, we, you know, the community needs to eject. You know, these people are leading you astray. And there's this awesome quote that proves that is a lie. In 1660, trying to list those involved in the riots that had racked Axholm since 1642, the sheriff of Yorkshire listed 13 men, then concluded rather lamely, and most of the inhabitants of the Isle of Axholm. And you can see the sort of legitimacy of the sheriff arresting anybody fading in that lame last phrase. And it's always, to me, so encouraging to see these moments of mass protest and the language of authority just sort of shriveling up a little bit in the face of it. You have no just claim. You have no claim to moral authority if literally everyone is protesting what you're doing. The other sort of strange thing that I've come across, and there's not a lot of conversation happening around it, so I don't know how to feel about it, as lame as that might sound. You know, I do rely on conversation to develop my thoughts and feelings. But I traded in a bunch of books at this bookstore. You know how that works. You trade in like 30 books, you know, probably like $300 that you spent over years. And they're like, okay, you've got like, you know, $25 in store credit. So rather than just getting a bunch, you know, five or six used books, I just was like, I'm going to get the most beautiful book I can. And there's this, you know, large format hardcover book of poems that has just a beautifully letterpressed cloth cover. Called Silesian Songs by Petra Bezruk, and I really know nothing about this poet other than, you know, he was an anti-imperialist, I believe Hungarian poet from the region of Silesia, and he was against the Prussian, the Prussian Empire. You know, sort of, you know, performing sort of acts of cultural hegemony over these regions of Hungary, and then also outside corporations turning, you know, Hungarians into lowly paid wage laborers and miners. And he draws on a lot of folk traditions, and he's also kind of a nationalist, and that always kind of creeps me out. But the value that I found in these poems, which a lot of times resemble ballads, you know, they're written around the end of the 1800s, I think, the beginning of the 1900s, is how they do register common rights, and they register just like a really fiery will to resistance sometimes. But this is a stanza from a poem called Marika Magdanova. Marika, it's freezing, and there's nothing to eat. In the hills, there is wood and despair. Mayor Hochfelder watched you gathering it. Should he say nothing? Marika Magdanova. Man, what I love about that is that it registers this common right, which is that to use the woods to gather firewood, but it's not like that sentimental about it. And in particular, there's this figure of sort of local authority watching Marika, and you get the sense that at any moment he could say something, and under the new regime, withdraw that right, use his power to punish her. And so there's a real clear-eyed vision of like a class struggle here and an anti-imperialist struggle in the poem, and it's so locally rooted. It's rooted in you know, things people are doing to get by, and the power structure and the specific figures and representatives of that power structure. Really cool. And then another line, what is the poem? Oh man, I don't, oh, the poem is just called, just some sort of Roman numeral. This is just a couplet from it. Sometimes, you know, it just a few lines of rebellion are kind of nice. Quote, by night I set fire to the wood stolen from me and shot down the hares on my master's estate. See, the other book I read was Heaven Is All Goodbyes by Tongo Ison Martin, and I need to thank my friend Ryan for introducing me to this book and making it part of this book club that we're doing. I don't have anything smart to say about it. I love it. I think it's a brilliant book. It's so politically trenchant, but not flat. There's also this excess of thought and emotion in it that exceeds sort of, you know, the bland truisms that we might apply to this moment. And for that, I'm really thankful. And it's also one that it's not full of doubt. It's full of this sort of resolve, this sort of like partisan energy, which I love. And the other thing I'll say about it is just that it's an elliptical book, really elliptical, and there's something in it that I've been trying to understand, like, how do you do this? How do you accomplish this? But it's that there are these almost like perfect epigrammatic moments throughout the poems, these couplets that say so, so much without seeming sententious or too pat, but that just seem like these little perfect, perfect moments in language. Yeah, so sorry. I guess that this is going to be full of hyperbole. I'm just going to read a couple of these, and I would encourage you to read them in their full context in the book itself. I will eat my dinner extra slow tonight in this police state candy dispenser that you all call a neighborhood. My art is rational, therefore my life is in danger from the simplicity of talent. A long look in the mirror, a stack of money starts talking from four cities away. The floorboards were right where the bottle said they would be. Yeah, I've been there. Here's another one. What fascists are determined to do does not scare most people. It makes most people bored, but we want our grandparents to survive. So that's Tongo Ison Martin, Heaven Is All Goodbyes. Something happened that was really unexpected a couple months ago, which is, somebody sent me a PDF copy of Enemy of the Sun, Poetry of Palestinian Resistance. And they reached out to me, you know, just kind of out of the blue, because I'd written a little bit on this subject. And I don't know much. I don't know nearly enough. But, you know, it was sort of like this beginning surface level research that made its way out into the world. And he was like, hey, man, I really want you to see, to have a copy of this book, you know. And I'm so thankful that this person reached out to me. And this person is Carl Carter Jr. He's a poet in, I think, Northern Virginia. Yeah. And he'd been part of the D.C. scene for a long time. And he wanted me to check out Enemy of the Sun, this Palestinian resistance book. And the more I read about it, the more I was just shocked that I didn't know about it, and two, the ways in which people have forgotten about it. And there's a couple reasons for this. It was published in 1970 by Drum and Spear Press, which was a really vital black press, part of a wave of like black bookstores and black presses in the late 60s and 70s. And they were located in D.C. and really a hub of literary and intellectual life for the Black community. And this book sold 10,000 copies, which is pretty incredible. I mean, it had a moment, and it was well read. And now there's just not much talk about it. It's like it almost didn't happen, which is a problem to absolutely in regard to how what we choose to remember about the history of, you know, poetry and poetry communities. And you know, it's got this introduction by Samuel Allen, where he's toggling between Palestinian poets Mahmoud Darwish and Sami El Kassim, I think, and then comparing them, doing sort of comparative reading with Black arts poets like Amiri Baraka and Don Lee. So there's this really rich dialogue happening in this book, and the introductions by both Sam Allen and then the two other editors, Nasir Aruri and Edmund Garib, are so crystal clear and so like provocative and productively so, and I think right in a lot of their comparisons of the sort of systemic racism that Black people have to deal with in America, and the Palestinians after the Nakba in the West Bank and Gaza and within the state of Israel itself. It's also an internationalist kind of outlook, as it also triangulates apartheid in South Africa to the sort of separate and unequal legal codes of Israeli state. So there's this great act of solidarity happening between these Black writers and Palestinian writers. And that seems really important. And this book is also, I think, helps signal the vitality of these Black-owned bookstores in cities. And so while everyone is doing research on, you know, the sort of cultural geography of New York school poets and thinking about those discourse networks, man, I would love to read some scholarship on these Black presses, on these other cultural formations, so that, you know, as I tend to do, that my idea of what non-academic publishing was isn't a totally monolithic and totally white one. Or one that's based in New York or San Francisco, which tend to, you know, cloud out cultural formations elsewhere. So that was cool. And I want to thank Carl Carter Jr. for sending me this, just going out of his way. You know, he's an older poet. I don't see why he would waste his time with me, but I'm thankful that he did. And he sent along his latest book of poems, Southern Road, and Selected Poems, which has some really beautiful, beautiful moments in it. So thank you, Carl. The last book I want to talk about is, you know, that registered things is, Strange Children by Dan Brady, you know, and I don't know, Dan was always somebody who showed up, you know, in the best possible ways, you know, in the DC community when I was there, in the scene, I guess you could call it, you know, I don't know if people have strong feelings about the word community and or scene, but either way, you know, Dan's one of those people who just quiet, you know, but plugged away, got behind other people's work, and you know, his first two books were kind of like projects, you know, particularly Cabin Fever, Fossil Record on Flying Guillotine. I think there were some like conceptual things happening where it was all one poem, but only parts of it were being revealed on each page. And so, you know, that's like a product of like some real, like, there's a lot of steps between that and an initial draft. And so I was really surprised to see Dan's new collection, Strange Children on Publishing Genius, which I think came out just this year. But it's totally different. I mean, it is like a total poetics, I think, of sincerity and poems striving for practical wisdom in just a really short amount of space. I'm just really struck, and it's cool to see somebody emerge with a totally different voice than the one I thought that they were working with. So just like a couple examples from the poem Light Year. To measure your loss, you must account for time and distance. You'll find as time increases, distance remains unchanged. Speed will increase as loss makes you lighter. And then just another, section from one of his poems. When you adopt, you will fill out a child desired form to articulate how comfortable you are being uncomfortable. Race, genetics, drugs, disease, mental health, gender, religion, openness, it's all uncomfortable. You need to know how much you can handle. You need to know how weak you can be. So these are poems that are like really settling, into their subject and turning, kind of patiently around it. So I was happy I got the chance to read Dan's book. All right. So I don't know. That's it. It's just the reading journal, skimming along. And I think some of these things I'll come back to. But most, maybe not. That's just the way it goes. I wanted there to be some register of this, and also, I'm just happy to have the opportunity, the time right now on my hands to read. Interested what other people have to say about these works. Hopefully I'll have more time for this. Not that I took that much time to make this. All right, let's see. Correction, Petr Bezruk is a Czech, not a Hungarian poet, and I am an idiot.